I'm Oliver Engelsson from Google, and I'm here to tell you about how we can parse to prevent pwnage, or ownage. And this is a position paper, invited paper, and really the technical work, the meat of this paper is by Mike Samuel, who is sort of the person who has maybe contributed most to Google technologies addressing the problem of rich content processing and composition. Now, because it's an invited paper, actually there was so little time pressure on us and other things to do that a lot of this paper got written in the last few days. And in fact, it's not on the web page, but you can have a sort of look at it by following the link that's on the bottom of the screen there. Now, you might wonder, should I follow that link? I think that's a fine question to ask. Now, of course, there's a bunch of links on this web page here. There's not a link to this particular paper. But you know, you might ask yourself, should I follow any of these links? Now, one common approach to sort of mitigating the risk of following these links is to somehow, let's see here, get somebody else to do the hard work. So, and let's see, here I have a PDF document that I decided not to trust because it's about all these very sort of scary people. Oh, that's Vitaly. Now, what I've done here by opening this PDF document this way is I've actually significantly reduced the attack surface that's available to would-be attackers. I've not eliminated it, of course, but I've significantly reduced it. And I could do the same thing with a lot of other types of rich content. For instance, if I look for this suspicious person here, find a whole bunch of images. Clicking on one of these images actually tells me a lot of stuff. It's a handsome fellow. He likes fancy cameras, or maybe, I don't know, that's Rebel is not the most expensive brand, but okay. So he has friends that have Canon cameras. Now, there's a lot of things going on here, but I've delegated most of that processing to Google. If I were to view this image, or if I were to actually click on this image here, and I would view the actual web page, this image, including all of the information about it being taken on a Canon camera, would be processed by my web browser. Maybe I feel safe because I'm using Chrome. I'm running in incognito mode, as you can see up in the corner there. But I'd rather not do that. In fact, I don't see any particular reason why all of that complicated processing should happen just to show that image. I would like to just get a bitmap. I do not care when showing that bitmap whether it's taken on a Canon camera. In fact, that's just risk that I would rather not assume. And it turns out that that risk is due to something that we describe in this paper called data confusion. And data confusion happens in lots of rich content formats. And just so that you don't think it's related to buffer overflows and to image formats or some binary formats like that, data confusion actually is quite well known in XML, which you know clearly is well defined. And there have been signature wrapping attacks on XML for at least the last 7 years that directly are caused by data confusion. So what do we actually mean by data confusion? Let's go back to the presentation here.
And what do you mean by signature wrapping?
You can read that. I'm not going to go into that. So basically, XML is very fungible. You can actually modify it in lots of ways. And you have these XPath statements that say, ooh, I signed this. So what is this referring to? Is it the first thing of that type in the XML structure? The last thing? Who knows? In fact, two different parties might make different decisions on that. So what is data confusion? That's exactly the point. Data confusion is when two different parties make different assumptions when they do processing in different ways. So it's vulnerabilities caused by inconsistencies between software in the parsing, composition, and processing of rich content. Motivation? Well, let's look at that Canon XT, Rebel XT comment. Boy, oh boy, we've seen that comment field in JPEG images come up again and again. Since 98, it's actually caused exploits in basically every software product that uses JPEG, which is basically everything. And we keep seeing the same thing. So one would think that having comments in image formats would be a simple thing, but no. Just recently, there was a problem with libpng. Just this year, there's a very serious problem with integer overflows, also caused by data confusion. And it seems that, well, if we assume that for display purposes on a screen in a web browser, you just need one color space. You just need the width and the height, and then some encoding of the actual bitmap contents. Maybe you don't encode it at all, if you just believe that compression on the wire would help. Why can't we lower it to a normalized, easy-to-resolve format like this protocol buffer definition? So here we would actually put all of the cost of developing correct deserialization, unmarshaling of this format into the protocol buffer handlers, which we can assume are pretty OK. Now, another motivation, upcoming paper by Vitaly's student, since I'm talking about him so much, Sumanyana, great guy, at Oakland. Antivirus scanning doesn't work. If you limit the inputs to antivirus scanners to only those files that are developed explicitly for the purpose of testing antivirus scanners, this is developed by the antivirus industry itself, they can't find them because of this problem. So you can actually have those files slightly tweaked, pass undetected through the antivirus engine, show up and do all of the work they were intended to do because of data confusion. And of course, it makes sense. The guys at the antivirus companies can't possibly write correct parsers for all of the world's formats and do it in a way that completely matches all of the different software that might open those files. Open Office is different from MS Office, et cetera. So the position in this paper is basically that we can, in fact, prevent data confusion. There's technical work in the paper that I encourage you to actually take a look at. Again, there's the tiny URL at the bottom. And the insight that Mike Samuel, who has been working on these data confusion issues in the context of the web, really made is that we only need to define annotated grammars for parsing. And then those annotated grammars can be developed independently for each rich format. So we only have to have as many of those as there are rich formats, and we can study them and try to work on them as hard as we can. We can even derive simple scanners for antivirus out of those that are faster, don't do fold parsing and so on. But we have to have those annotated grammars, and annotations include things like those resolutions in XML. What do you exactly mean when you say that something was signed elsewhere in the XML document? Which one? And then we can actually have primitives that those annotated scanners tie in with in languages and platforms. And we only need to develop those primitives once for each language and each platform or each web framework. And all of this works really by resolving ambiguities to fully resolved, normalized, clearly understood forms. So data confusion on the web. So this is basically, 4 minutes in. These are the high-level ideas, and now there's like technical content. And so we have this web application shipping some content around, and we know that if they make mistakes, those web applications can have cross-site scripting, SQL injection, all kinds of things. Now, there is this contract that's assumed by developers, but of course does not hold true. And this is sort of somewhat fundamental to data confusion, although this is not the only cause of data confusion. But you can sort of think that these equalities kind of should hold, but we know that they don't. And this is where the problem arises. How would we actually fix this with grammars? Well, we can have grammars that define what is an HTML document or rich content. There are some tags there. There are some attributes. And this is a regular grammar. We have an example of that in the paper. But it doesn't define what is, yes?
So for the first talk, told us that there are hundreds and thousands of protocols, and building handlers from them is really going to be unscalable and infeasible. So how many grammars do we have to write in your approach? Is there sort of...
Linear. So if there are hundreds of thousands of protocols, pick the ones you think are important and develop it once for each.
So how many rich formats do you think are of interest right now?
Well, how many rich formats are actually usable in a web browser? Let's start there, because I just... Lots. But it's, you know, it's actually doable. How would you actually, you know, how did we actually do all of that demo stuff in the web browser earlier? Well, we simply used an entire web browser, right? We actually didn't even try to enumerate what these were. We just did basically screen captures out of, you know, stuff that's run inside a sandbox web browser. So this is one way of actually resolving that. And then we don't even have to fully enumerate it. We just have to look at what is the eventual output. Now, so there are shortcuts for developing these grammars. And you could actually, so one of the things that we describe in the paper is basically sandboxing. And then you strip out lowered content out of the sandboxed execution. But the thing to note about grammars is that standard grammars do not define what's safe, how things are resolved, how data is encoded and maybe nested inside other data, how references inside the rich content data may actually refer to elements or units inside the content, etc. So to answer Niels's question with a demo, let's actually look at something really cool that was developed by people at Berkeley and Don Son's group. So let's see here. Okay, man. Woo! So, okay, well, you saw enough of the demo. I promise not to actually. I'm sorry? Yeah. So what that was a web browser, okay, rendering rich content. Okay, so you saw that, and you saw me interact with the thingy, so I actually used the mouse. You didn't see that. There was no JavaScript running inside the web browser. All of the JavaScript is actually run inside a sandboxed browser on the server, and the DOM tree and all of the positions and so on, when I actually did the movements, is actually marshaled out of that sandbox execution and sent over to the client. So basically, for all web pages in the world, you have only a handful of JavaScript that you would ever run on the client. Huge reduction in attack surface. Okay. So data confusion, one way of dealing with that in the web content, of course, not always possible to do it this way. Yes.
So are you, for that demo, you mean essentially...
Talk to Don Song about
the details of
the demo.
I think you'll... I actually worked with her on part of that, so...
Yeah, okay.
But I think with that demo, you're framing essentially a thin client-style approach where the computation is done remotely and the...
Where content is lowered. So thin client means that the client does not have a lot of functionality.
Right.
Again, means that it doesn't have a lot of attack surface.
Right.
Where the content is lowered to meet reduced functionality, therefore
right.
reduced attack surface on the
right.
client.
Right, so I buy that argument, and yep. we have a paper in USENIX ATC on sort of that argument. Sorry. But I also buy the opposite, which is that I think history has shown that our greed for rich interaction
exactly.
is often in tension with how much computation we have and how much communication
yeah, which
we
is
have.
Why this approach is not enough. So we can't just always push the problem onto somebody else. And that's actually where the technical, that's why these grammars make sense. So with these grammars, you can actually allow processing to happen safely on the client, including execution of code, et cetera. Now, safely means that we've significantly reduced the attack surface without resorting to these tricks of just, you know, delegating the problem to somebody else. So the proposal is really that we use annotated grammars. And these are technologies that Mike Samuel has been developing for a while. And these annotated grammars basically add the information we need to avoid data confusion to the parse trees. And these would be developed by security experts, by pen testers, by people like Mike Samuel and so on, which anyway need to do that for their job. Google needs to understand all of this. It's just that there does not exist a public grammar for how this gets resolved. So the benefits, yes.
So when you go down this path, it seems you're going to face this point in the grammar where what the thing is an opaque blob of bytes. And you get in a lot of trouble at that point because now what do you do? In mm-hmm. other words, so are you coming from a premise of...
So remember that proposed image format here.
Yeah.
So you have one opaque blob of bytes, okay, in sRGB. So you've removed all the stuff about color spaces and so on. But I haven't specified it. Is this like compressed in JPEG format? Is this PNG or something? But it's clear that there is no metadata here describing what this is, so we have to assume it's like one thing. And since it's just the bitmap, there's no parameters or options, those parameters or options have basically been hard-coded when this thing is processed.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I'm wondering about two things. Mm. One is people prefer to ship around programs and not bitmaps because programs are much smaller.
Right.
And here you don't have that option. Right.
Right.
This is reduced to a form that's not beautifully compressible compared to a program.
Yes.
The other is, I'm not quite sure from the scope of what you're framing, whether you're really more or less targeting web interactions and what's visible, or a much broader space of file formats and protocols and so forth.
So the focus of the paper and the focus of the technical work we've done is the web. But the web includes protocols. It includes code and data. In fact, most of the hard issues are dealing with permitting code, because you can't really permit CSS without permitting some form of code and so on. So a lot of it actually comes from dealing, sort of breaking open those opaque blobs in structured ways. And that's what these grammars allow us to do, and allow certain aspects of functionality without opening up the door to arbitrary rich functionality. Okay? So, because basically I have, 5 minutes left?
I'll shut up in a sec. But I don't know if this is on your radar or not. We have a paper on strongly typed networking, which has this sort of spirit, but it's for networking,
right.
And we want to annotate exactly, essentially, the associated semantics with network protocols and network activity so that one gets out of this data confusion problem.
I don't think the problem is specific to networking.
Yeah, right. No, I'm not.
No,
it sounds like
your sentiments were very similar to the ones that we have here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you just clarify what you mean?
You're next.
Just very briefly, have you guys taken these proposals outside to Google to like the open web application security folks, or
so there,
have you talked to anybody?
Mike Samuels has implemented the Clojure automatic templating system, which actually makes use of these techniques, although there is no sort of public grammar that is separately specified out. But that all of this work really comes from templating systems and work on preventing cross-site scripting and similar attacks that is actually open source. And there's a reference to it in the paper. So Fabian, regarding scopes, it's actually, what is within the B and the opening B and the closing B, so that indicates like boldface text and what should actually, the fact that those two elements actually form a nesting scope, that's actually nowhere in the grammar for HTML. Let's move on. So we could have one, benefits, like one grammar for each of these content languages, one code generation for C, Java, Python, and we talk about what code generation means. It's basically how do we move these grammars into something that happens at runtime and uses security primitives. Instead of having, n times m, where n is the number of content formats and m is the number of platforms, we have n plus m. So the work is greatly reduced. And it's much easier to vet a new language or a new platform or a new framework, because you basically then say, well, can you deal with all of these grammars? Do you have the primitives to do this correctly? Now, there's basically three techniques, apart from sandboxing. We've actually seen a bunch of sandboxing. But for actually dealing with content, for cracking open and using those opaque blobs, we can have lowering encoders that basically take iHeartPonies and actually change that to I less than three ponies. Sanitization, which moves nice website into with some script stuff in there and strips out the script in a reliable fashion. And contextual templating, which is the closure framework is contextual templating, also called auto-escaped templating, where in the each context, the right type of either sanitization or lowering is performed. And so these are the sort of fundamental building blocks of how you would allow processing and compensation to happen securely. Now, basically lowering encoders, that's sort of simple. We take data that might be very complex, but in each case, we want to move elements of that data into a form where it's completely innocuous, sort of as plain data or plain text as possible in the processing. And so I can sort of go into how we develop these automata. In the technical work of the paper, shows how to develop pushdown automata that encode these grammars and then figure out automatically compile how these grammars and automata can be compiled into efficient code run inside the platform. So for each platform, let's say the Django framework in Python, you could actually have an automatically generated mechanism for performing, lowering, auto-templating, and so on for any content, as long as you had a grammar and a system for compiling those grammars into Django. However, I think we're out of time, like 5 minutes ago. Is that correct?
No, you're good.
Okay, how much time do I have? Okay, so let's then actually see how this might work. So we have some values here. The structure is an array of strings. We can break this into tokens or events for the automata and start sort of playing the automata forward. So you can sort of see how, okay, we're in this state and so on, and we go forward, and each time until we're in an accepting state, we're actually not allowed to emit something. So it's not safely lowered. Now, there's one back end. There's a way of actually enumerating possible traces and eliding a lot of these steps. So the problem with this is you wouldn't want to actually do this for each and every character. It would actually be quite complex. So you'd want to collapse as many of those, and that's the magic of the compilation, so efficiently compiling these. But there are techniques for that. Now, sanitizers are really taking some noisy, untrusted data and converting it into innocuous regular data, where really what that means is that the set of functionality has been greatly reduced. You are going to allow some functionality, like boldface text and so on. You're not going to allow attributes that include like JavaScript as the parameter or CSS, et cetera. And so we drop meaningless content. So we take like HTML comment and just remove it. It's not necessary. It's kind of like that Rebel XT from Canon comment that I really don't need to know about in the web browser to see that image. So we just remove that. We remove the hello comment here. We convert to standardized forms. So that means that a span class foo would actually get the quotes on the foo. And so now we don't have to even think about the possibility that there might be some unquoted attribute here. And then we replace dangerous content. So if we have JavaScript evil, we actually, or anything that might possibly be JavaScript as an attribute, we convert that to something safe, like the fragment identifier here. Now, contextualized templating uses these lowering encodings and sanitization in the correct way in each and every context, and does so dynamically at runtime. So when you're processing the data, because eventually, and I think probably that is the question that the gentleman was talking about with opaque blobs, eventually we run into the halting problem. You have some stuff that gets used by a program. The big program is really just an interpreter for the stuff. And will the program do foo at runtime? We don't know. That's usually for most rich content formats that include code and all kinds of composing and processing, it's basically the halting problem arises very quickly. But if you actually at runtime ensure that every time you're doing any sort of composing and processing, you're sanitizing and lowering encoding the content in the right way, in the context that you find yourself at runtime, you can actually allow content to be safely processed. So it sounds like Fabian is sort of raising his arms. And
one more minute, and then I know there are a number of questions.
OK. I'm just going to sort of move forward here. Contextual templating, you can sort of see how in different contexts we need to do different types of encodings. Like URL encoding is not the same as different encodings and so on. And then finally, you would like this to be the case that when you're using this in a language, you can just write this particular PHP or JavaScript. You can just say that, yeah, sure, I want to do hello, and then I want to have like this world data show up there. And then the automatic templating system should figure out what the context is correctly based on the actual program that you're writing. And so we shouldn't require developers to completely change how they do work just to make use of these systems. So, Niels?
Sure. So it sounds like these annotations are extremely time-consuming, and you know you have to get lots of corner cases right. Are there any fundamental guarantees that you'll end up with sound annotations?
Nope. But you could take individual implementations and model the annotations that you've given against those implementations, static or dynamic analysis, and actually come up with guarantees. But you're absolutely right. It's incredibly laborious and time-consuming and annoying work. But it's already being done. It's just it's not being utilized as efficiently as possible. Like Mike Samuel has been doing this for years. And then once you've done this, you have no guarantees. So that's where actually we could develop techniques to take individual implementations and say, sure, actually all the right things will happen at runtime and it's correctly modeling.
So that's where my confusion comes in, because it seems you said earlier that you know with these three facets of annotation, scope, and your interpreter, or whatever it was called, that you were able to get
annotation scopes and resolution of references.
You were able to get programs or something. You were able to assert, you get in a situation where it's easier to assert the soundness of what you're looking at now, right? You say
yes.
I still don't see why that's the case. Right? Because it's so
You basically resolve ambiguities. There is no bottoming out. You don't get to the place where you basically know everything there is to know in the world, all things are safe, and nothing will ever change. You do not get there. However, you do resolve a whole bunch of ambiguities, and you know the XML question is for instance, best. So if instead of having an X path that might resolve in different ways, depending on how the XML content is reordered and so on, if you simply required that there be a unique ID, referring to an XML portion of the XML, you know, an attribute, or I forget what they're called, but basically a node with this particular type, and it's unique. And the references to that node are unique as well. And there can only be one, so that's actually enforced at runtime. So it doesn't matter where it will be moved around. If one party did some checking and checked the signature, nobody else is going to be confused as to what exactly it checked. Because it's
unique.
But
doesn't that also require now that all programmers buy into your view of the world and how?
Sure. No, that's where you would actually but you would like them to be able to write things the same way, and you would like as much of this. And if you read the paper, it's all about how can we actually get this to happen automatically, being driven by these parsers and by functionality inside the platforms, not by the programmers. The programmers will write this. I mean, we shouldn't fool ourselves. They will in fact write this. So the right thing has to happen. So and that's Mike's sort of point.
Okay.
And anyway, this is our position. It's a position paper.
I'm just wondering if you're
it's a reasonable position.
If you believe all of that would happen, isn't there going to be a simpler solution in the end? But I'll take it offline.
There's not a simpler solution for data confusion. So given the number of formats and platforms and new platforms and new formats that are always arising, and legacy stuff, and broken software, and so on, you're not going to avoid data confusion on the web. You're going to have it. So then the question is, what are you going to do about it? As far as I know, this is sort of the best approach that anybody knows about. Yes?
I'd say ambitious.
I'm sorry?
I'd say ambitious. I don't know if I'd say better.
Oh, sure. It's ambitious, of course. You know, positions should always be ambitious.
Hi. So I was wondering, when you said to strip away the Canon text from the image file, me personally, I'm not that much into photography, so I'm perfectly fine with that information being gone, but there is other people
depends
that are very much
context.
Interested in that.
Depends on the context. So right now, that comment is not stripped from any single image that hits your web browser. Okay? Does it make sense that when you download the image and open it up in Photoshop, you get that comment? Sure. Would it be safer if you got it as a protocol buffer thing? That might actually, because Photoshop doesn't know anything about protocol buffers, be lowered or resolved into a JPEG file format so that Photoshop can open it. Yeah, it would be much safer.
I guess where I have a problem with this is that you're talking about taking complete languages, and you're going to run into the halting problem when you're trying to parse them down to something that you can trust.
Yeah, but the halting problem doesn't actually cause any problems at runtime. You know when you halt it. So that's where the automatic templating says. There's nobody here saying you do static analysis. What you do is actually you make sure that at runtime, the right primitives, which is the lowered encoding, the sanitization, and the automatic or, you know, templating, templating.
Already you said, I'm going to take this and I'm going to parse something that I know is not is a complete
You can
language.
Parse content. You can
You're
parse content.
Parsing content.
And that parsing will also happen at runtime. You don't do it once. You would have the halting problem then. Because you don't know how the content will generate new content and so on.
Exactly.
So you know, eval in JavaScript, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you push the parsing also happens at runtime.
Okay.
Right, yep. Well, let's thank all for one more time.